Shabbat Shalom. I don't have a sermon for you this morning. That doesn't mean we get out any earlier. Rather, I have a report, an update, on the current state of affairs in Israel. And I want to be clear that I'm not here to take sides on any of the issues, but I think that it's very important to understand how complex some of these issues are, and how I believe this is a very critical time for Israel. I firmly believe that the next few months will determine the fate of Israel for the next few years, and a few different factors play into this determination. I returned last week from a wonderful 8-day trip to Israel with the family minion. I added up all of my trips to Israel, and this was my 12th trip, the 6th time in the past 7 years. Now, many of the times that I've been to Israel have been with tour groups, so I expected that I had already seen pretty much everything that there was to see. But I was pleasantly surprised that we saw and did things that I had never seen and done before. But the best part was seeing the country alive and seeing it thriving. In 2001, I led a birthright trip to Israel, and this was right after the Second Intifada broke out. And as you can imagine, things were very tense in Israel. Then I went on 2 missions, one in 2002 and one in 2003, and by then the country was on full alert. We drove down deserted streets in the heart of Tel Aviv and in the heart of Jerusalem, past empty cafes and shops, and it was just heartbreaking. Then in 2004, Alicia and I lived there in Jerusalem for a year, and things were starting to get better, but things were still tense. The difference now, I have to tell you, is night and day. Our tour guide told us that this is the first year that Israel has surpassed the number of tourists that it had at its peak in 2000. And it truly shows. The streets are full of people, as are the shops and the cafes. People are happy. There's just this general sense of calm in the air, and there's a lot of construction going on, and the economy is really thriving. However, if we were just to look at this veneer, if we were just to judge Israel based on this veneer of what we see on the street, we'd be missing quite a lot. I believe that the next year will be one of the most significant years in Israel's history. And I want to share with you what we saw and heard over the 8 days in Israel. Now, I'm not as well read as Rabbi Wolpe in English literature, but the quote that kept recurring in my head over the course of those 8 days was the opening line to Charles Dickens' famous novel, A Tale of Two Cities. It was the best of times, it was the worst of times. It was the age of wisdom, it was the age of foolishness. It was the epic of belief, it was the epic of incredulity. It was the season of light, it was the season of darkness. It was the spring of hope, it was the winter of despair. Israel's truly existing in this binary state, a state of tension, but even more so than normal. And this state of tension will not last forever. Eventually, one side will prevail. And I want to give you a few examples of what I mean. On the second day that we were in Israel, we were taken to the Israeli Arab village of Barta'a, which is in the Lower Galilee, which sits literally on the Green Line, the line that was the armistice line set in 1949, which became the border between Jordan and Israel. Now, when the negotiating teams drew this armistice line, drew the green line in 1949, they were looking at topographical maps, but not always necessarily looking at maps where cities and villages were. So they saw a valley, and they decided that that would be a good place for the armistice line, and it was convenient. But the village of Barta sits on two hillsides straddling this valley, and the village was literally cut in half. So people could no longer see their families if they were on the other side of the hill. They may live maybe 100 yards away, but now they were in separate countries. Now, when Israel reconquered the West Bank in 1967, the village was reunited, and the inhabitants were happy to no longer live separated from their families. Then in 1993, Israel handed over civil administration to parts of the West Bank to the Palestinian Authority under the Oslo Accords. Now, at this point, the part of the village that was previously under Jordanian control came under civil Palestinian control, and the part of the village that was within the borders of Israel remained under Israeli civil control. Now, more recently, Israel has been building a security fence around the West Bank to prevent the infiltration of suicide bombers, and this has been tremendously successful in saving the lives of Israelis. And when they made the security fence in the area of Barta'a, they made it so that both sides of Barta'a are now on the Israeli side of the border. Now, as our tour guide kept telling us, now things get complicated. If you live on the side of Barta'a that was under Palestinian control, and you want something from your government, from the Palestinian government, you have a problem because your government can't access you because the fence is there. So if you need an ambulance or if you need the police, you have a problem. So there's a certain amount of lawlessness in the village. But that also is not necessarily always a negative thing. The fact that Palestinian Authority can't have access to that side of the village means that there's no taxes. So the side of the village that is under the Palestinian control has been on a tax holiday for the past few years. And this has been a tremendous boost to their economy. A lot of Israelis now shop in Barta'a, at least the side that is on the tax holiday, because they charge no sales tax there, so the prices are cheaper. And before they had 2 stores on that side of the village, now there's 600. So in the village of Barta'a, it's truly the best of times, and it's truly the worst of times. And their village is this microcosm of the tension present all over Israel. We also spent time in the far north of Israel, a few kilometers from the border with Lebanon, just in the shadow of the Golan Heights. And we visited the parking lot where 12 Israeli soldiers were killed instantly when their unit was hit by a Katyusha rocket as they were preparing to go into Lebanon to stop the rocket fire. On Wednesday morning, if you are following the news, Israel traded the bodies of 200 Lebanese and Palestinian terrorists and 5 live terrorists, including the infamous Samir Kuntar, for the bodies of Eldad Regev and Ehud Goldwasser, the 2 soldiers whose kidnapping by Hezbollah sparked the Lebanon war. Now, there's a division in Israel as to whether this exchange was the right deal to make. Israelis were hoping that these 2 soldiers would be alive, but even if they were not, they still wanted the bodies back so that their families could have closure and so that the soldiers could have a proper Jewish burial. But at what price? There are fears that this deal will only encourage Hezbollah to go out and have more kidnappings. And there are others, though, who say that Hezbollah doesn't need any encouragement to go out and kidnap Israeli soldiers. Even if they just want to hurt Israel, they'll go and do that, even if they don't expect to have some exchange later. There is a fear that the fact that we just negotiated with Hezbollah gives them legitimacy in the eyes of the Arab world. While there are others who say that whether or not Hezbollah has legitimacy in the eyes of the Arab world is not the issue. The issue is that they're still funded by Syria and Iran. And we should worry about how to stop that and not worry about Hezbollah's public relations. And there's also the fear that this will embolden Hezbollah and a third Lebanon war is just around the corner. Except now Hezbollah has even more rockets and longer range rockets, and Hezbollah knows that Israel will have to invade with large amounts of ground forces to stop the rocket fire, and they're preparing for that. And of course, Israel is also preparing for that eventuality, or for that possibility, I should say, with newer rocket defenses and for better strategies for eliminating the threat from Hezbollah. Now, part of eliminating that threat is preparing the home front. Before leaving for Israel, the family minion, spearheaded by Ron and Rana Spiegel, raised $25,000 to pay for the rehabilitation of a large public bomb shelter in the north of Israel. We were able to visit that bomb shelter, which is in a religious girls' school in Tzfat. It's still under the process of construction, but it should be finished in time for the school year to start. Now, many communities around the United States are sponsoring these bomb shelters because there are literally thousands of shelters that are in such states of disrepair that they're not inhabitable for even 1 hour, much less many days, which is what is needed in case of another Hezbollah attack. Things in the north are progressing, and the fact that there has been calm in the north of Israel over the past 2 years, has meant that people and tourists have returned to the north, and the economy is thriving once again. In the north of Israel, it is truly the best of times, and it is the worst of times. The threat from Hezbollah frightens Israelis, but they know that Hezbollah cannot really hurt Israel as a state. Hezbollah can cause a lot of fear, and they can cause some damage, but Israelis know that they don't threaten the existence of the state of Israel. When Israelis worry about an existential threat, they worry about the threat from Iran. Now, we had the unique opportunity of visiting an Israeli Air Force base and hearing from a cousin of Marcy Leiter's, a lieutenant colonel in the Israeli Air Force, about Israel's military capabilities. Israel is still by far the greatest and most advanced military in the Middle East. And no country would dream of challenging Israel in a conventional war. But of course, the threat from Iran is not conventional. The attitude in Israel right now, the attitude of the government right now, seems to be to plan for the worst, but to hope for the best. The Israeli military just conducted a huge military exercise with hundreds of aircraft to simulate what an attack on the Iranian nuclear facilities would look like. But at the same time, Israeli politicians are toning down their rhetoric with Iran, not wanting to escalate a war of words into an actual war. There's also the belief that Israel needs to just wait and see what happens in the Iranian presidential elections, which are scheduled for about a year from now in mid-2009. If Ahmadinejad is reelected, then we can probably expect more of the same from Iran, and we can plan for that eventuality. But if someone else is elected, maybe there will be some room for a political solution. Israel is stronger than ever, but Israelis hope that they don't ever have to use their strength. Now, while in the north, we also had the pleasure of rafting down the Jordan River. Now, this was a fun respite from some of the more serious touring that we were doing, and it was a great way to beat the heat. But no one could avoid how filthy the river was. There was a strange smell, I have to admit, that wafted up from the river, and all the way down as we were taking this raft ride, there was litter all over the banks and in the river. Now, Israel is a small country with few natural resources, and Israelis can hardly afford to spoil the few natural resources they have. And water is a resource that will become ever more critical in the coming year. While I was in Israel over that week, the Kinneret, the Sea of Galilee, passed an important benchmark in terms of water use. The Israeli Water Authority determined that if the level of water in the Kinneret drops below a certain level, that the concentration of pollutants makes the water undesirable to drink. Now, this level is known as the red line, and when the water reaches this red line, the Water Authority stops pumping water out of the Kinneret, stops bringing the water to the other parts of Israel that are drier. Now, on July 7th, the level of the water in the Kinneret dipped below this red line, and it continues to go down. So that means for the next few months, summer months, the hottest and driest months of the year, no water is going to be pumped out of the Kinneret, which provides Israel with 25% of its fresh water supply. Now, until that water level rises above the red line, Israel will be without this fresh water supply. And even though they've stopped pumping the water out of the Kinneret, the water level still goes down every day just due to normal evaporation. Every day the water level goes down just about 1 centimeter. So if you figure that in Israel they don't expect rain until Shmini Atzeret, the day that we pray for rain, because that's when the rainy season begins in Israel. So that means for the next 94 days, they figure there will be no rain in Israel. And that means for the next 94 days, the water level will continue to go down in the Kinneret. And this is significant because there is another benchmark below the red line, which the Israeli Water Authority measures, and it's called the black line. The black line is the level where the pumps are, the pumps that pump the water through the national water carrier to the other parts of the country. And when the water level reaches the black line, the water pumps are exposed to air and they can no longer function. So that means that even if Israel needed to pump water out of there for an emergency, they couldn't, because the water level is below the pumps. Now, this water crisis is severe. And Israel is facing this water crisis despite all of the water-saving technology that Israel already uses. The only bright side to this crisis that is facing Israel right now is that Israel is facing it now, as opposed to down the road. And Israel will have to innovate right now and will therefore lead the world again in water-saving technology. Israel has already transformed the way the world uses water by inventing things like drip irrigation and by saving things like wastewater. Now Israel will be in the forefront of the next generation of water-saving devices, which will be desperately needed as more and more countries are confronted with the reality of dwindling freshwater supplies. With Israel's water supply, it's truly the best of times, and it's the worst of times. From the north, we traveled to Jerusalem, where we had another opportunity to learn about the separation fence, hear how it relates in particular to Jerusalem. Now, the separation fence is not merely a fence. In some parts, it's a series of fences with electronic sensors which monitor any disturbance to the fence. And there's also a tracking path and there's a patrol road which allows the army to track and quickly respond to any infiltrators. In other parts, it's a concrete wall, also with an electronic monitoring system. Now, the separation fence has been invaluable in saving the lives of Israelis from terrorists. But it's not without its unintended consequences. In some portions of Jerusalem, the separation fence runs along the municipal boundaries of the city. In other portions, the fence goes more into the West Bank to include Jewish neighborhoods, not technically within the boundaries of Jerusalem. In other portions, the fence cuts off some Arab neighborhoods that are within the municipal boundaries of Jerusalem and leaves them on the side of the West Bank. Now, this may seem well and good if we say that we simply want to have more Jews together in Jerusalem and fewer Arabs in Jerusalem. And that's not a light matter at all. When Israel reunited Jerusalem in 1967, the population of reunited Jerusalem was 75% Jewish and 25% Arab. Now, 40 years later, and despite the efforts of the government to encourage Jews to live in Israel, the population of Jews living in Israel has actually dropped. Right now, the population of Jerusalem is only 65% Jewish and 35% Arab. And the number of Jews in Jerusalem continues to go down as more and more middle and upper class Jews leave Jerusalem because, unfortunately, Jerusalem is the poorest city in Israel. Now, this is a real problem, especially considering the fact that the entire area around Jerusalem is very Arab. Jerusalem has grown so large that the northern outskirts of Jerusalem now border the southern parts of Ramallah. And the southern parts of Jerusalem now border the northern parts of Bethlehem. Now, if you drew a line of just 5 miles around the borders of Jerusalem and counted the population within that extended boundary, you would find that the population is actually 80% Arab and only 20% Jewish. But let me get back to the fence. The fence, which fences Arabs out, also fences Arabs in. And the significance of that has been shown dramatically over the past few months. In March, if you recall, a terrorist gunned down 8 yeshiva students in Jerusalem. Now, this terrorist wasn't able to slip by the fence because he didn't have to. He was an Arab resident of Jerusalem. He was legally allowed to live in Jerusalem and to travel all over the city. And the week that I was in Israel, another Arab went on a rampage with a bulldozer and killed 3 people. He too was a legal resident of Israel. And there's a dispute, they're unsure whether he was crazy or whether he was simply crazy or whether he was a terrorist. Now, many people say that these actions are not an indicator of the attitudes of the majority of the Arab residents of Jerusalem. And some people say, though, that even if the majority are peace-loving, even having a small minority who are militant terrorists is unacceptable. And they feel that all Arabs should be fenced out of Jerusalem. Fencing out all Arabs, though, is not without its consequences either. In the city of Jerusalem, it's already completely divided by neighborhoods. There are almost no areas where Jews and Arabs actually live together in the same neighborhood. If the fence only keeps Jews out, only keeps Jews in and keeps Arabs out, then there's no such thing as a reunited Jerusalem. And there's no legitimate claim to say that Palestinians cannot have Jerusalem as a capital of their own. Now, these delicate issues were brought to light for me when I heard a presentation from two men, one Palestinian and one Jewish, from a non-governmental organization called the Israel-Palestine Center for Research and Information. Now, this organization right now is working on behalf of the government, trying to negotiate the release of Gilad Shalit, the soldier who was kidnapped by Hamas over 2 years ago. And this organization is also advocating and strongly pushing the government of Israel to conclude a peace agreement with Mahmoud Abbas and the Palestinian Authority within the next 6 months. They assert that the negotiation process is pretty much concluded. From the point where the negotiations broke off in Taba in the year 2000, the two sides were very close to an agreement. And they believe that the two sides can easily bridge this small divide if they will just take the time to sit and negotiate. They also believe in this so firmly, and their timetable is so short, just 6 months, because the alternative in their minds is terrible. Mahmoud Abbas, the president of the Palestinian Authority, will be running for re-election in January. And they believe that Hamas will run a candidate against him. And if he has nothing to show for his time in office, then he will lose. Then Hamas will not only be in control of the Gaza Strip, and not only in control of the majority of seats in the Palestinian parliament, but they'll also be in control of the presidency, which is the most powerful position in their government. Right now, Prime Minister Olmert is under investigation for taking bribes and for other illegal monetary activities. And he said that if he is indicted, he will resign. He's also facing a challenge within his own government. The Labour Party chair, Ehud Barak, threatened to withdraw his party from the government, which would cause the government to collapse and force new elections, if Olmert's own party doesn't hold a primary election, which means that Olmert now has to run to be the leader of his own party. And the assumption is, because he has such low approval ratings, that when he runs in this primary election, he will lose. What would happen is that the Kadima party, Olmert's party, would remain in government, and the government would remain intact, but there would be a new prime minister. The Kadima party primaries are scheduled for mid-September, just 2 months away. Now, the representatives of this non-governmental organization believe that if there is no peace agreement that settles all of the issues between the Israelis and the Palestinians, then not only will Mahmoud Abbas lose his bid for re-election, but most likely the government in Israel will fall because of the scandals that are going on there now. And with Israelis staring at Hamas all around them, they will most likely elect a Likud government with Bibi Netanyahu as the new prime minister. And in their minds, this is the terrible scenario, because they believe that these two governments looking at each other will just lead to a long, long round of bloodshed on both sides. Now, they're realists in their analysis, because they do believe that if Abbas and Olmert sign agreements, that both of their governments will fall and that new elections will have to be held. But they believe, based on the fact that numerous opinion polls show that the majority of Israelis and Palestinians want a peace agreement, even if it means serious concessions, that in the end, the elections for the new Israeli and Palestinian governments will essentially be a referendum on the agreement, and that the majority of people will vote in favor of that agreement over continued hostilities. Now, I wish I could share their optimism. I do understand their sense of urgency, because I think that they're exactly right about what will happen with the Palestinians. I do think that Hamas will try to unseat Abbas. In fact, that may be their primary reason for agreeing to the ceasefire in the Gaza Strip, so that they can focus their energies on winning that election. What makes their idea so intriguing for me is that it's so unorthodox for Israel. The conventional wisdom in the Middle East is that only strong leaders can make compromises. Only Menachem Begin was able to withdraw from Sinai. Only Ariel Sharon was able to disengage from Gaza. Yet here we have two extremely weak leaders, Abbas and Olmert, who are negotiating from a position of weakness. So maybe there will be an agreement, because both of them have nothing to lose. Now, it would be amazing to have peace. Unfortunately, I doubt that it will happen. I hate to be pessimistic about peace, but my feeling is that, unfortunately, there will be more bloodshed in our future. For their plan to work, everything has to work just so perfectly. The negotiators would have to finish their negotiations in just a few months. Both leaders would have to sign their agreements and then prepare their elections for elections of new governments, and the public has to support it. And all of this can go wrong with only minor interference. What if Hamas decides to renege on their pledge of a ceasefire and starts shelling Sderot again? Israelis will legitimately say, what's our agreement worth if Abbas can't control Gaza? And who is going to go into the Gaza Strip to disarm Hamas? The prospects for peace are slim, but they're possible. The prospects for continued fighting, unfortunately, seem much more likely. In Jerusalem, it's truly the best of times, and it's the worst of times. What I hope you take away from this report on Israel is not only the fact that the issues facing Israel are very complex and multifaceted, and not only that many different forces are converging simultaneously to make the next few months critical in determining Israel's future in the coming years, but I also want you to take away that it's time to re-engage with Israel. If you haven't been to Israel recently, you have to go. Go with your family or go with Sinai Temple. We have plans in the works for a trip to Israel next year. Get involved with organizations in Israel or with organizations here that support Israel. Whether your interest is political or religious or social or environmental, there are organizations that would love your participation and your support. Sha'alu shalom Yerushalayim, Yerushalayim yishalyu ohavayich, yihi shalom b'cheilech, shalva b'armanotayich, lema'an achai v're'ai adab rana shalom bach, lema'an beit Adonai Eloheinu avak shatov lach. Pray for the peace of Jerusalem. May those who love you be at peace. May there be peace within your walls and security within your citadels. For the sake of my brothers and friends, I pray for your well-being. For the sake of the house of the Lord, I seek your good. Shabbat shalom.